You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday the 2nd of December 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at radioalbion.com because we have with us geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from russjournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I hope that you weren't too offended by my imitation of your voice last Thursday for the Thanksgiving episode on the Constitution. I did my best to do justice to your introduction and everything else.
You did excellent. You did excellent. And I very much appreciated that. And I'm sure the listeners did as well. I know you wanted to catch up with podcasts because you had some time off when you were ill. So I think you did very well there covering on the Thursday anyway. And I'm very, very grateful for that. And I mean, listeners may not be aware that you always provide the content for these Thursday shows as well. You dig out the articles and then I prepare the notes. So just to give you credit where credit is due. And today's article, actually, it's one that's written by Alexander Dugin about liberalism's drive for war. So we're going to be talking about these provocations that are going on against Russia and what's really going on there and what is likely to be the end result of them, because a lot of people are very concerned that there might actually be war at the end of it. Well, recently, the escalation of US-Russian relations has been clearly visible. This is the second episode since the spring of 2021, when many expected a go-ahead to Kiev from the neocon-backed globalist Biden for an offensive in the Donbass region. But then everything was limited to Zelensky's ridiculous arrival from the NATO zone and convincing manoeuvres of the Russian armed forces on Russian territory. This turned out to be enough. Then Washington made an attempt to disrupt the launch of Nord Stream 2, but again failed since the European partners simply rejected this policy. Then Biden focused on the withdrawal of American forces and their accomplices from Afghanistan and the creation of the Anglo-Saxon Coalition, or OCAS, against China, as well as the quadrilateral Quad bloc, where the United States included Japan and India. And again, everyone is against China. With the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan and proceeding to the withdrawal of troops from Syria, or so far only in Iraq, Biden gave a signal of his patheticism. But OCAS and Quad are rather a tribute to the neocons and the hawks. However, the withdrawal of troops is a fact, and the coalitions created are so far only a simple opportunity, a threat, and not a blow. And I really hadn't paid that much attention to this, but this OCAS, this is to do with why this deal between Australia and France, that was torpedoed, wasn't it? And the French were really upset about that, and apparently the Italians were as well. And it's Britain, Australia and America working together against China, I believe. And this Quad is the same, but it also includes Japan and India. Is that correct, Matt? Is this a really big thing? Because it, you know, it really sort of escaped me when this happened.
Yeah, I think it escaped a lot of people. AUKUS is it's a trilateral security pact, as you mentioned. Australia, Australia withdrew from the first one, from the quadrilateral security dialogue. But this is a state-owned company in France helping to put together an Australian nuclear submarine, the attack class, and because it was an American private firm that went in and undercut them and got this contract. And that's really where the AUKUS thing came from. The whole point of it was to get an American blue chip firm to go in and take care of this incredibly huge. I mean, they've already spent a few billion dollars in the French project, and they withdrew because AUKUS was done without French knowledge. It had nothing to do with really. It was in September, and now because the UK left the EU, they can engage the US or Australia. They're not under any legal restrictions in dealing with Australia or any of these other countries. So that's how they took advantage of that. So really, it's the way that the US is cutting out the rest of the EU, especially France, because the French were always very iffy. They were iffy about NATO to begin with, and now very iffy about the policy in the South Pacific. So this is an absolute disaster, and it shows you that Australia, US, UK are forming something completely separate from NATO, something completely separate from the European Union. It's a big deal, a very expensive deal.
Well, just before I move into the next section, I note that Dugan refers to it as an Anglo-Saxon alliance. And of course, we're usually traditionally thinking white Anglo-Saxons, well, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. I mean, it's just pretty much white people. And it's a term we don't usually hear very much from. In actual fact, academia in Britain have said that we shouldn't use the term Anglo-Saxon because it's linked with white supremacists. So what do you make of Dugan calling it an Anglo-Saxon alliance? I wouldn't call it that really, because, you know, I think of it as an ethnicity. But what do you make of that?
Well, remember, when he talks about whether the West, Western European, Anglo-Saxon, he's not referring to people. He's talking about an ideological liberal movement for global domination under the capitalist mentality. So he gets in trouble for using phrases like, oh, the West is doing X. And that's what he's referring to. So as far as AUKUS is concerned, yeah, you're talking about incredibly alienated elites. But what he means is that it comes from this modern capitalist ideology, and that is very anti-Russian, very trade-oriented, very based on sea power. That's what he means. He's not talking about me and you, even though I'm a Celt, but he's not talking about that as a race. He's talking about an ideological movement.
You know, I would like to see America and Australia and Britain working together on the basis of the fact that we all originated from England in the main, and we all speak English and have it based on ethnicity, but certainly not as a way to just go after China and Russia. Well, there are three zones of growing conflict, and these have come about basically after this withdrawal from Afghanistan, which apparently caused serious discontent amongst the neocons. And they demanded that the president, who is seeking deeper into old man's dementia, take decisive steps. This was reflected in the escalation of relations, this time not with China, but with Russia, which we are witnessing today. The tension has synchronously increased along the entire perimeter around Russia, and there are three zones of growing conflict which are clearly visible there. Belarus and the crisis with the migrants on the Polish border. Here, the logic of Lukashenko's behaviour is quite rational, who calmly accepts in his country migrants rushing to the European Union, not paying any attention to Poland, which in turn, after the elections in Minsk and mass liberal protests, refused to build any constructive relationship with Lukashenko. The tension on the border and the gathering of Polish troops there creates a hotbed of tension between the allied Russia and Belarus and the United States, the EU and NATO. But Lukashenko has nothing to do with it. He just symmetrically responds to NATO rudeness and the attempt of the regime change operation that was undertaken by the globalists under his nose. Parallel to this, the movement of the armed forces of Ukraine began in the Donbass region. The Minsk agreements were essentially completely crossed out by Kiev. Punishers began to see settlements located on the territory of the DPR. The speeches of some Ukrainian politicians are indicative here when they call on their American partners to intervene in the situation, support the restoration of Kiev's control over Donbass, and if necessary, join in a direct military confrontation with Russia. This confrontation will inevitably arise, since today it is obvious to everyone that if Kiev starts a full-fledged military operation, Moscow will not leave its citizens from the DPR and LPR, who have long received Russian passports in large numbers, to their fate. Once again, the situation is escalating, and Washington makes it clear that this time it is determined and ready to support Kiev. And finally, we have the NATO military exercises in the Black Sea and the entry of the US 6th Fleet warships into the port of Batumi. This is intended to demonstrate that the US is well aware of the urgency of the moment and is ready to support Ukraine in a possible conflict with Russia. The Black Sea Basin, Washington makes it clear, will be used in this case to attack Russia, or at least to contain it. And the bit that I like about this is, you know, he's got a really good point there about Poland being next door to Belarus, and the Poles just basically funded that revolution and encouraged it, and they're helping out these people that tried to topple Lukashenko. So, you know, he's going to respond to that, and he's just responding in kind, saying, well, we're not going to stop these migrants from trying to make their way across anymore. And this this is the first we've heard here as well about there being people in the Donbass that are moving in there and seizing Russian property. You know, we've heard that there are movements on Russian movements in Russia, but we haven't actually heard what's been going on in the Donbass. So what's been going on in this Donbass region, Matt?
Well, you know, back in 2014, when that war started in eastern Ukraine, I was the first to translate their constitution and their Declaration of Independence into English. And it is what you can only really call a social nationalist or even a national socialist movement there, and that they defeated the Western-backed Ukrainian military, which, you know, wasn't very hard to do, since they usually deserted and fell apart. And they're really not going to die for the oligarchic system in Ukraine. They've maintained their independence. Russia has not formally recognized them, but they have recognized them informally. The ceasefire, the Minsk Agreement ceasefire, hasn't really held. A lot of civilians get killed. And I guess part of the reason why the oligarchs – I mean, remember, Ukraine is an American colony in every respect. But there is no independent Ukraine, because that country would fall apart immediately without immediate Western assistance. It's the only reason. It has nothing to offer the West. It has nothing to offer in terms of trade or anything else. The currency is worthless. The only real profitable industries are in the East, where they mine the coal, where their industry exists. And that's why the rebels took it over and instituted a system that would be very successful had it not been for the massive, a constant worry about the military operations from Ukraine. The only way that Ukraine could do anything in eastern part of the country, in the Donbass area, is with Western assistance, Western troops, Western weaponry. And so maybe the oligarchy going into trying to take over and possibly planning military operations at least makes sense, because Ukraine could never – they've already lost that war. And part of this interest in going to NATO has everything to do with trying to retake that area. But we'll see here in a minute that Dugin doesn't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, there's all these provocations that are going on, but he's of the belief that it's just saber rattling. He says, so for the second time during Biden's presidency, relations between Russia and the United States have reached a critical point. This explains the direct dialogue between Russian President Vladimir Putin and CIA Director William Burns, who recently arrived in Moscow for this purpose. Such an asymmetric dialogue is conducted only in extreme conditions. In other words, we are on the verge of a war, and it can begin in one of three zones of growing escalation: on the Belarusian-Polish border, in the Donbass region, or in the Black Sea, or perhaps in all three regions at the same time. But the biggest argument why war is unlikely to happen is that Biden has no mandate to do so. His ratings are falling, everyone is unhappy with him, not only Trump supporters and Republicans, but also his own party members and voters. Biden can't do anything. Everything falls out of his hands. He forgets the words, greets the ghost, falls asleep wherever he can. To start a war against the nuclear and militarily and psychologically quite vigorous Russia of Putin, albeit partly by someone else's hands, requires iron legitimacy. This might be justified, as it puts all of humanity on the brink of destruction. No one in the world doubts Putin's determination to stand up for the freedom and independence of Russia to the end. And just imagine, in such a situation, the grandfather, almost completely out of his mind, orders forward, attack, follow us. And what is behind us? Soros, LGBT+, gay parades, replacement of humanity with artificial intelligence, a system of global network censorship and tracking, Zuckerberg out of his mind, believing that he is already living in a science fiction film. And this is what you will fight Putin with? On the other hand, this is not just the opinion of Biden's opponent, an ordinary American, but also of most of his supporters, except for maybe neocons, but they are not complete maniacs and suicides. They study geopolitics and hopefully are well aware of the realities of a true balance of power. Now, I think he may not necessarily be right here, Matt, because, I mean, when people have like falling ratings, one way that they can build up their ratings is to go into war, isn't it? And then everybody gets behind the person that's gone into war. So he seems to be discounting that when he says that Biden's not going to do anything because his ratings are bad. Have I got a point there, or is there a counterpoint?
No, I think you do have a point there. Sometimes he could be a bit naive in American politics, but it's to be, you know, can be forgiven under the circumstances. His broader point is, I mean, we've talked about it on this show endlessly. The U.S. military is literally and figuratively falling to pieces. There is no real esprit de corps. There's really the money is, you know, barely existent. The debt is incredible. We talked about ships running into each other, airplanes. I mean, right now, maybe between 40% and 50% of naval aviation can fly. They don't have the pilots. They don't have the equipment. Where's this $1 trillion a year going? Plus the fact that the military has been torn apart also by, as he mentions, the queers, the freak, the artificial intelligence, the lack of training, and the fact, like in Ukraine, I'm not sure how many of these guys are willing to die for BlackRock. If you remember, I used to, when I had a Facebook, I used to put these pictures of these military men putting a piece of paper in front of their face saying, I didn't join the Marine Corps to fight for the oligarchy in Syria or something like that. The desertion rate is high. I can only imagine a military that's lost every battle it's ever fought certainly in the last generation, with high casualties and everything else. Now they're going to take on Russia and China at the same time? So it's laughable. And of course, there is no Biden. Biden doesn't know where he is. It's BlackRock. It's a handful of billionaires who pull the strings. And Biden is a very, very convenient front man. We've dealt with all this on this show 100 times. And Dugin, for the most part, gets it right.
Well, the Russians would be fighting for Russians, the same as the Chinese would be fighting for the Chinese. And they would completely trounce America. I mean, we saw that with the Afghans who were fighting for the Afghans. And the Americans were fighting for gay pride and Soros and Zuckerberg's Facebook. And they were completely wiped out just by the mountain men in their sandals in Afghanistan. I mean, you know who would win a battle between them and Russia. And all of this means that this perimeter escalation is most likely nothing more than another bluff. If so, then the limit on intimidation of Russia after the situation returns to normal will be exhausted. Swinging twice and never hitting means only one thing. The aggressor is not at all capable of hitting. That is not an aggressor, that is a scarecrow. There seems to be no result. Everything is as it was. The armed forces of Ukraine will return to their barracks. Migrants will make their way through the forests to Germany. And US warships will go to their usual places of deployment in the Mediterranean Sea. But everything is not at all the same. From now on, you can simply wipe your feet about Biden like a doormat. He is irresponsible, this pathetic old moron. He may even die of shame. Kamala Harris, for whom the globalists had so many hopes, may also disappear, since she turned out to be just a fool and everyone turned away from her. But still, when the situation escalates so sharply, one cannot be completely sure that nothing will happen. Therefore, the likelihood of war must be taken seriously. However, the Russian leadership, Putin, Shoigu, Lavrov, are demonstrating this. Hence our symmetrical exercises. The sharpness of the reaction to the provocations of the US armed forces near our borders and the aggressive gestures of Kiev. Russia is ready for war. It is clear that everything will be done to avoid it, but if those same red lines are crossed, Russia will accept the situation with courage and dignity. And here there is one very interesting difference. Putin has a mandate to fight defensively. Patriotic sentiments in Russian society are already extremely high, and after the first shot, God forbid it should sound, they will rise to the skies. And Putin has full legitimacy in domestic politics. and we hope that the technological potential of the Russian army will be enough. And this is the point, isn't it? It's the Russian spirit that they have is, you know, it's just they actually have a spirit. Americans don't have a spirit anymore. They don't have anything to fight for. What do you make of his conclusion here, Matt?
Well, you don't have to be pro-Russian, as pro-Russian as I am, to agree with him. We, you know, talked about many times how high-tech stuff tends to not matter when there's boots on the ground. It was one of the lessons for Iraq that no one, the Iraq war that no one took seriously when I did my paper on the massive number of casualties from the UK and the US in the first and second Iraq wars that no one knows about unless you speak Russian. You know, I talked about the fact that even Russian intelligence says any high-tech stuff that the U.S. used immediately became irrelevant once there was actually a shooting war in the trenches. The only thing that matters then is not even numbers, but the spirit of the nation. The U.S. is not a nation. It wasn't even really founded as a nation except the fact that the initial ruling class in the Federalist Party was almost identical ethnically and racially and to a great extent politically, though not obviously not entirely. That used to be the case. I did my thing on the Constitution last Thursday making this point. The U.S. Constitution is not really designed for a massive war, especially a lost war. And I think the first thing that's going to happen is that the state, if this happens, the state and media are going to get together and completely, I mean, violently control information. Because journalists are embedded in American military units, we have no clue what's going on there. The only reason I do is that I can read Russian and Ukrainian press. And I have people reading the Arabic press, even the Iranian. And there, of course, you get a totally different point of view. So that's what I've been spending a lot of my time on. So the U.S. military is literally and figuratively falling to pieces. That is the argument that Dugin should make. Not that Biden doesn't have any legitimacy. Of course he doesn't. There is no such thing as Biden. It's BlackRock and a handful of blue chip companies. No, it's that the condition of the U.S. military makes even a small minor war almost impossible.
Well, it's not so much a case of being pro-Russia as it is being pro-ethnocentrism, isn't it? Russia is more ethnocentric than the West, and China is arguably more ethnocentric than Russia. And therefore, you have to say, well, they're doing the right thing, and you have to highlight the positive outcomes of being ethnocentric in the hopes that we in the West, white people in the West, will realize that and regain our own ethnocentrism. Well, let's have a look at a summary here of everything. To summarize, Russia has a better starting position in this escalation than the United States. Moreover, in the event of a direct conflict, Moscow has a chance to improve its geopolitical position qualitatively and in one stroke and in all three directions. In a critical situation, unification with Belarus will happen rapidly. Novorossiya from Odessa to Kharkov will finally be liberated. And then there will be two Ukraines, one of which will pay for everything, from Maidan to the punitive raids. In Georgia, with God's help, a national neutral regime will be strengthened, with which it will be possible to positively develop relations. And yes, the price matters, but all great things are paid for in blood. And what does the USA get? Russians cannot be killed directly. Putin's position is absolutely firm. No one in their right mind can count on the direct occupation of Russia, and even more so on the basis of an incapacitated proxy in the form of Ukraine. I mean, this just, it just seems so sad to me that Russia and Ukraine are at one another's throats, Matt, because they are essentially the same people, aren't they? I guess it's similar to the troubles with Ireland and the United Kingdom in a way. But it just really saddens me to think that, because you can really tell that there's this real dislike that Putin has for Ukraine here, can't you?
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about, again, a colony of the West. We're not talking about Ukraine as an ethnic unit. Yeah, those two ethnicities are distinct, but not to an extreme case. Not even like, you know, the Poles. Very different world there. I mean, they're two Orthodox people who spent most of their time together rather than apart, although that's certainly not the case in the Middle Ages. I have a book on Ukrainian nationalism, partially published by Russia Insider on Amazon right now, that gets into this, that even in Western Ukraine, you don't have an anti-Russian mentality. About 50%, this is a few years ago, 50% of Western Ukrainians see Moscow as positively, which no one is is reporting. And I've said 100 times that Ukraine, which has the most educated population, I think, in the world, larger percentage of people with advanced degrees in Ukraine than anywhere else, the tremendous potential for high tech and everything else has been turned by the West to fourth world status in a couple of decades. And that's really the price they have to pay for this ridiculous Western assistance, quote unquote, that's turned them into this third, fourth world country with a low birth rate, a massive brain drain. It reminds me of the whites in South Africa. And so there is a tremendous pro-Russian movement there. And that's why Kiev has to totally control the media directly, or the U.S. has to control the media directly. Russian media sources have been shut down. They're in prison. They've been driven out of the country. And that only in the Crimea do you have any kind of pro-Russian media. So there's a reason they had to shut all that down. And if shooting starts, everything he says here – now, remember, I didn't translate this. I got this in English from somewhere else. When he says, yes, price matters, he means the cost of a war like this, even though it would go Russia's way and it would change everything. That's what he's referring to here. So, you know, he's talking about – he doesn't really believe a war is going to happen. But if it were to happen, this, you know, at least three points would be made, would occur. And then the other thing I want to mention, I've said this a long time ago, is that if there's a shooting war, American allies are going to fall apart. Poland is not going to want to fight this. Germany will refuse to fight this. I'm not sure about Turkey at all. You'll see a closeness between China, Russia, Iran, Armenia, and Pakistan. I don't think the Japanese or the Australians are going to be interested in this. Central Europe and Eastern Europe would go right back to the Russians again. Again, no one's dying for the European Union. No one's dying for NATO, and no one's dying for capitalism, but that's what they're expected to do in this case.
It's like the gay lobby are expecting everybody else to fight for them and die to force gay rights on the rest of the world in a way. Well, let's finish up with a look at this AUKUS and Quad. Among the most recent important events in the field of geopolitics that followed the shameful flight of the Americans from Afghanistan, one should especially highlight the revitalization of the Anglo-Saxon alliance in the Pacific Ocean. In a fairly quick time frame, the Biden administration, in order to brighten up the depressing effect of the failure in Afghanistan, announced the creation of two new strategic alliances, AUKUS and Quad. AUKUS is a purely Anglo-Saxon phenomenon based on the integration of the strategies of the United States, Great Britain, and Australia. At the same time, Washington demonstratively expelled France and Italy from it, which at the same time lost the naval orders from Australia that were extremely important for both European countries. The effect was so strong that France recalled its ambassador to Washington for consultations. Such arrogance, according to many experts, actually undermines NATO as a whole. In fact, AUKUS is implementing the program of the American neocons to create a close alliance between the Anglo-Saxon powers and exclude Europe from there. Well, Matt, you were saying that, you know, it's the EU that people are fighting for. I mean, what he's saying here is this is excluding the EU, and it seems to me this is excluding NATO as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I mentioned that in the first part of the show, and I've written it many times, is that this kind of thing is taking advantage of Brexit, and of course the French debacle is splitting the continent right in half. This is a good thing as far as we're concerned. Because remember, the American military, the American foreign policy spreads liberalism. That's its sole exclusive purpose. So whenever they get into trouble, whenever they mess up, whenever they lose, it's a victory for us. There's no doubt about it. And but everything he's saying here is correct. Remember what we said, what Anglo-Saxon means in his mentality. You have to be very careful there. But yeah, part of how they're taking advantage of Brexit is to do an end run around at least the EU. And that's why the French were able to pull out of the deal with Australia, the nuclear submarines, and get away with it. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say pull out. They were kicked out, and the Australians were able to get away with that along with Britain and the US. They can get away with it because, again, there's no legal connection with the EU anymore.
Well, the other organization or alliance that was mentioned there is Quad. Another Quad alliance consists of the same USA and Great Britain, but this time it includes two Asian powers, India and Japan. If Japan is not independent, and after World War II is only a US military base, in fact an occupied territory, then with India everything is much more complicated. During the Cold War era, India, while formally adhering to a non-aligned status and being one of the initiators of the non-aligned movement, was nevertheless closer to the USSR, and Pakistan was in the zone of Western influence. In recent decades, everything has changed radically. Pakistan turned sharply away from the West and reoriented itself to China. India, on the other hand, began to draw closer to the United States and move away from Russia. But it is India in Quad that acts as a subject capable of making decisions on its own. Moreover, New Delhi has maintained good relations with Moscow. It is quite obvious that both AUKUS and Quad alliances have a strictly anti-Chinese orientation. China has recently become so strong that it has ceased to hide its geopolitical subjectivity. Rather, it is impossible not to notice it further. China and Russia, each country in its own way, insist on being the poles of a multipolar world. Russia is primarily in the field of armaments and energy. China is in the field of economics. And they do it. The unipolar and multipolar world is communicating vessels or a fixed sum equation. If one arrives at one, it arrives at the other. To add something to one, you must subtract from the other. The weakening of the US grip in Central Asia and the Middle East, as well as in Europe and other areas of the world, objectively strengthens China and Russia, as well as everyone who plays on the side of multipolarity. That's Iran, Turkey, Pakistan, and others. Since for the Anglo-Saxons, the economy is above all else, they decided to focus on preparing for a war with China, leaving Russia for later. It is this goal that AUKUS and Quad follow. AUKUS should provide the Anglo-Saxons with an instrument of military influence in the Pacific Ocean under the sole control of the Anglo-Saxons, so that the Europeans, God forbid, would not ruin everything by making a dissenting opinion. But I find interesting in that is this explains why there's been so much immigration from Pakistan into Britain, because Pakistan was allied with the West against the USSR while India was with Russia. I wasn't aware of that. But what are your final thoughts on all of this, Matt?
Well, I think part of the movement here is that India is more or less at war with China in the Himalayan mountains. That's probably the one thing that's bringing them to this alliance. Pakistan has been pro-China for a very long time and doesn't mind the war with India. But as I said before, and by the way, I don't like his use of Anglo-Saxon, as if the Anglo-Saxon race is somehow opposed to Russians and Chinese. I don't like it. But again, it's an ideological term, not an ethnic term. But as I said before, these alliances will fall to pieces if there's any kind of even an increasing threat of any sort of a shooting war. No one trusts the Americans. No one believes that they can win a war. No one trusts me. The fact that they're encouraging Australia to pull out of its deal with France, we've dealt with 100 times where the U.S. has simply pulled out of treaties. It's an untrustworthy country. No one really takes the U.S. seriously militarily and even economically, let alone in terms of this pulling out of treaty after treaty after treaty, economic agreement. They've been doing this for since the Cold War ended. So no one trusts it. They can't win anything diplomatically or certainly not economically or militarily. So this is what's going to happen here. It's a complete disaster. The Chinese and the Russians are going to win immediately without even a shot being fired, because the West, Western Europe, simply doesn't have the money. And don't forget, all these countries, Central Europe, Pakistan, India, Japan, these are heavily involved in trade with the Chinese. West Central Europe is trading with the Russians. So economically speaking, the debt that all this brings these countries closer to Russia, China, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, than to the West, which they don't take seriously in any respect.
Well, I think America is like a civilization in its death throes, isn't it? It's like a chicken running around with its head cut off, not knowing which direction to go in. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.